Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, June 2nd, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, sunshine and clouds mixed, a stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Highs around 85 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, some clouds this evening will give way to mainly clear skies overnight. A stray shower or thunderstorm is possible, lows to 69 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts mostly sunny skies, highs to 91 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page, titled Ukraine Destroys 40 Aircraft in Russia. This article was written by Samia Kulab of the Associated Press. Dateline Kiev, Ukraine. A Ukrainian drone attack has destroyed more than 40 Russian planes deep in Russia's territory, Ukraine's security said on Sunday, while Moscow pounded Ukraine with missiles and drones just hours before a new round of direct peace talks in Istanbul. A military official who spoke with the Associated Press on condition of anonymity to disclose operational details said the far-reaching attack took more than a year and a half to execute and was personally supervised by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In his evening address, Zelensky said 117 drones were used in the operation. He claimed the operation was headquartered out of an office next to the local FSB headquarters. The FSB is the Russian Intelligence and Security Service. The military source said it was an extremely complex operation involving the smuggling of first-person view or FPV drones to Russia, where they were then placed in mobile wooden houses. Later, drones were hidden under the roofs of these houses while already placed on trucks. At the right moment, the roofs of the houses were remotely opened and the drones flew to hit Russian bombers, the source said. Social media footage shared by Russian media appeared to show the drones rising from inside containers while other panels lay discarded on the road. One clip appeared to show men climbing into a truck in an attempt to halt the drones. The drones hit 41 planes stationed at military airfields on Sunday afternoon, including A-50, Tu-95, and Tu-22M aircraft, the official said. The Moscow previously used Tu-Pulev, Tu-95, and Tu-22 long-range bombers to launch missiles at Ukraine, while the A-50s are used to coordinate targets and detect air defenses and guided missiles. The Security Service of Ukraine said the operation, which it codenamed Web, destroyed 34% of Russia's fleet of air missile carriers, with damages estimated at $7 billion. The claim could not be independently verified. Russia's Defense Ministry in a statement confirmed the attacks, which damaged aircraft and sparked fires on air bases in the Irkutsk region, more than 2,500 miles from Ukraine, as well as the Murmansk region in the north, it said. Strikes were also repelled in the Amur region in Russia's far east and in the western region of Ivanova and Ryazan, the ministry said. Also on Sunday, Russia's deep investigative body said explosions caused two bridges to collapse and derail two trains in western Russia overnight, killing seven in one of the incidents and injuring dozens more. Russian officials, however, did not say what had caused the blast, and the word explosions was later removed from the investigative committee press release. The drone attack came the same day as Zelensky said Ukraine will send a delegation to Istanbul for a new round of direct peace talks with Russia on Monday. In a statement on Telegram, Zelensky said Defense Minister Rustem Umerov will lead the Ukrainian delegation. We are doing everything to protect our independence, our state, and our people, Zelensky said. Ukrainian officials had previously called on the Kremlin to provide a promised memorandum setting out its position on ending the war before the meeting takes place. Moscow had said it would share its memorandum during the talks. Russia on Sunday launched the biggest number of drones, 472, on Ukraine since the full-scale invasion in February 2022, Ukraine's Air Force said. Russian forces also launched 7 missiles alongside the barrage of drones, said Yuri Ignat, head of communications for the Air Force. Earlier Sunday, Ukraine's army said at least 12 Ukrainian service members were killed and more than 60 were injured in a Russian missile strike on an army training unit. Ukrainian army commander Mykhailo Dropati later Sunday submitted his resignation following the attack. He was a respected commander whose leadership saw Ukraine regain land on the Eastern Front for the first time since Kiev's 2022 counteroffensive. The training unit was located in the rear of the 620-mile active front line, where Russian reconnaissance and strike drones are able to strike. Ukraine's forces lack troops and take extra precautions to avoid mass gatherings as the skies across the front lines are saturated with Russian drones looking for targets. The next front page article is titled Democrats Looking to Rural America. This article was written by Bill Barrow of the Associated Press, Dateline, Paintsville, Kentucky. Janet Lynn Stumbo, 70, leaned on her cane and surveyed the 24 or so voters who convened in the small Appalachian town to meet with the chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party. A former Kentucky Supreme Court justice, Stumbo said the event was the biggest Democratic gathering I have ever seen in Johnson County, an enclave where Republican Donald Trump got 85% of the presidential vote last November. Paintsville, the county seat, was the latest stop on the state party's rural listing tour, a periodic effort to visit overwhelmingly white, culturally conservative towns of the kind where Democrats once competed and Republicans now dominate nationally. Democrats' path back to power may start here, one small meeting at a time, because it will be difficult, if not impossible, for the party to regain U.S. Senate control or win the presidency without competing harder for rural and small-town voters. The party recently lost senators from states with significant rural population, Montana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Democratic-led states also lost population to Sunbelt states led by Republicans, with some projections suggesting Democrats would lose 12 seats in the Electoral College in the 2030 census. The gut check is we'd stopped having these conversations in white rural America, said Coleman Eldridge, the Kentucky Democratic chair. Folks didn't give up on the Democratic Party. We stopped doing the things we knew we needed to do. It's not that Democrats must carry most white rural precincts outright to win more elections. More realistically, it's a matter of consistently chipping away at Republican margins in the way Trump narrowed Democrats' usual advantages among black and Latino men in 2024, and not unlike what Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear did in 2 statewide victories. Nationally, Trump won 60% of small-town and rural voters in 2020, according to AP VoteCast data, and 63% in 2024. That's a far cry from a generation ago when Democrat Bill Clinton won pluralities in Johnson County on his way to capturing Kentucky's electoral votes in the 1992 and the 1996 White House races. We have to be intentional about how we build something sustainable, Eldridge said. It's not like we haven't won here before. For 2 hours in downtown Paintsville, Eldridge listened as Stumbo and others took umbrage at conservatives' policy agenda, expressed frustration over Trump's standing in eastern Kentucky, and said they were determined to sell their neighbors an alternative. Many brought their personal experiences to bear. Sandra Music, a retired teacher who called herself a new Democrat, converted because of Trump. She bemoaned conservative success in advancing private school tuition voucher programs and said they were threatening a public education system meant to ensure that we educate everybody. Music criticized Republicans for making a caricature of Democrats. They want to pull out keywords, abortion, transgender, boys and girls sports and distract from the rest of the Republican agenda, she said. Stumbaugh lamented what she called the rightward lurch of the state and federal courts. Michael Heffill, who works in healthcare information technology, was incredulous that the billionaire president took hold of voters in Appalachia, historically one of the country's poorest regions. "It's not left versus right, it's rich versus poor," he said. Shaking his head at working-class white voters, Johnson County is 97.5% white, voting against themselves. Ned Pillersdorf, who is married to Stumbo, went after Republicans for their proposed federal tax and spending plans, especially potential cuts to Medicaid. He said Paintsville still has a rural hospital, which is among the largest employers in the region in no small part because Kentucky is among the GOP's leaning states where a Democratic governor expanded Medicaid under the 2010 Affordable Care Act. Elridge, the first black chair of a major party in Kentucky, mentioned Trump's attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives and related civil rights laws and regulations. Eldridge and Nicholas Hazlett, the Johnson County Democratic chair, who was a college student doubling as a Paintsville City Council member, acknowledged that the small crowd was Democrat-friendly. No one was there waiting to be convinced. Across the street, antique shop owner Michelle Hackworth said she did not even know Democrats were holding a meeting. Calling herself a hardcore Republican, she smiled when asked if she's considering attending. "They wouldn't convince me of anything," she said. Bill Mike Runyon, a self-described conservative Republican who is Paintsville's mayor and loves Trump, went immediately to social and cultural commentary when asked in an interview to explain Johnson County politics. "Democrats," he said, "have to get away from the far-left radical. Look at the transgender message." Further, Runyon said, "Everything got kind of racial. It's not like that here in Paintsville and in Johnson County, but I can see it as a country. It's making people more racist against one another." Asked who he was talking about, he alluded to progressive U.S. representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Latina from New York City, and Jasmine Crockett, a black woman from Texas. "It's the ones you always see on TV," the mayor said. Bashar seems to be the one Democrat who commands wide respect in and around Paintsville. Democrats hailed the 47-year-old governor for supporting abortion and LGBTQ plus rights, while still attracting support beyond Democratic strongholds. Bashir did not win Johnson County, but got 37% of its vote in his 2023 re-election and carried several nearby counties. Multiple Republicans, including the mayor, complimented Bashir for his handling of disasters in the region. "He's been here," Runyon said. "Absolutely can get him if I need him." Our next front page article is titled, "Half of the World Endured Extra Month of Extreme Heat." This article was written by Isabella O'Malley of the Associated Press. Scientists say 4 billion people, about half the world's population, experience at least one extra month of extreme heat because of human-caused climate change from May 2024 to May 2025. The extreme heat caused illness, death, crop losses, and strained energy and healthcare systems, according to the analysis from World Weather Attribution, Climate Central, and the Red Cross. Although floods and cyclones often dominate headlines, heat is arguably the deadliest extreme event, the report said. Many heat-related deaths are unreported or are mislabeled by other conditions like heart disease or kidney failure. The scientists used peer-reviewed methods to study how much climate change boosts the temperatures in an extreme heat event and calculated how much more likely its occurrence was because of climate change. In almost all countries in the world, the number of extreme heat days has at least doubled compared with a world without climate change. Caribbean islands were among the hardest hit by additional extreme heat days. Puerto Rico, the territory of the United States, endured 161 days of extreme heat. Without climate change, only 48 would have occurred. "It makes it feel impossible to be outside," said Charlotte Gossett Navarro, chief director for Puerto Rico at Hispanic Federation, a nonprofit focused on social and environmental issues in Latino communities, who lives in the San Juan area and was not involved in the report. Even something as simple as trying to have a day outdoors with family, you weren't able to do because the heat was too high, she said, reporting feeling dizzy and sick last summer. When the power goes out, which happens frequently in Puerto Rico, in part because of decades of neglected grid maintenance and damage from Hurricane Maria in 2017, Navarro said it is difficult to sleep. If you are someone relatively healthy and is uncomfortable, it's hard to sleep. But if you are someone who has a health condition, now your life is at risk, Gossett Navarro said. Heat waves are silent killers, said Frederick Otto, associate professor of climate science at Imperial College London, one of the report's authors. People don't fall dead on the street in the heat wave. People either die in hospitals or in poorly insulated homes and therefore are just not seen, he said. Low-income communities and vulnerable populations, such as older adults and people with medical conditions, suffer the most from extreme heat. The high temperatures recorded in the extreme heat events that occurred in Central Asia in March, South Sudan in February, and in the Mediterranean last July would not have been possible without climate change, according to the report. At least 21 people died in Morocco after temperatures hit 118 degrees Fahrenheit last July. People are noticing temperatures are getting hotter, but don't always know it is being driven by climate change, said Roop Singh, head of urban attribution at the Red Crescent Climate Center, in a World Weather Attribution statement. We need to quickly scale our responses to heat through better early warning systems, heat action plans, and long-term planning for heat in urban areas to meet the rising challenge, Singh said. City-led initiatives to tackle extreme heat are becoming popular in parts of South Asia, North America, Europe, and Australia to coordinate resources across governments and other agencies. One example is a tree planting initiative launched in Marseille, France, to create more shaded areas. The report said strategies to prepare for heat waves include monitoring and reporting systems for extreme temperatures, providing emergency health services, cooling shelters, updated building codes, enforcing heat safety rules at work, and designing cities to be more heat resilient. But without phasing out fossil fuels, heat waves will continue becoming more severe and frequent, and protective measures against the heat will lose their effectiveness, the scientists said. The next front page article is titled, Arizona's Agritopia, A Bit of Farm and Suburbia. This article was written by Melania Walling, Anika Hammerschlag, and Joshua A. Bickle of the Associated Press, Dateline Gilbert. Just steps from the porticos, patios, clay-tiled roofs, and manicured lawns of suburbia, Kelly Saxer has gotten used to questions as she weaves through tomato vines, snaps of asparagus, and generally gets her hands dirty. Visitors and even some nearby residents want to know what she's doing and how the farm where she works wound up here. Sometimes it feels like we're animals in the zoo, a little bit, because people will walk by and they'll just stare, you know, like gawk at us, Saxer said. This is Agritopia, an 11-acre organic farm that's all that remains after miles of alfalfa, corn, cotton, durum, wheat, and sugar beets were swallowed up by Phoenix's roaring development. In this agrihood, a residential community that includes a working farm, kids play outside at a school that borders vegetable fields or in communal green spaces nestled between homes. Well-dressed couples and boisterous teenagers flock for selfies and picturesque photos. Lines form at the diner featured on Guy Fieri's Food Network show. On the farm itself, people can walk the dirty roads, rent out plots to grow their own foods, or buy its produce. Some developers have turned to the agrihood concept in the past couple of decades to lure buyers with a different kind of empty. at least 27 U.S. states and Canadian provinces had aggregates as of a 2018 report from the Urban Land Institute, and have more cropped up since then. Experts say agri-hoods cater to buyers interested in sustainability, access to healthy food, and a mix of urban and rural life. The core aim of many projects is to create a feeling for people, said Matt Norris, one of the lead authors of that report. It was the late 1990s when the family behind Agritopia saw the writing on the wall, said Joe Johnston. The family farm was some 5 miles from Gilbert then, but it was clear the Phoenix area's rapid growth was going to bring development to the doorstep. With his parents mostly retired and a pair of brothers interested in doing other things, Johnson got their blessing to develop the land himself rather than simply selling it. Johnston, with a background in design engineering, was intent on creating place, as he puts it. The neighborhood features narrow streets and homes within walking distance of restaurants, bars, shops, small parks, and fitness businesses. The farm is at the center of it. Melissa Checker, a professor of anthropology at City University of New York and author of a book on environmental gentrification, said agri-hoods can appeal to people in different ways. Their desire to feel environmentally conscious, nostalgia for an imagined idea of the past, increased interest in food self-sufficiency, and even a heightened desire to be safe and connected to neighbors after the COVID-19 pandemic. You have kind of a convergence of some commercial interests, you know, something that you can sell to people, and then also this real desire to change the way we do things, she said. In an ideal world, using green community space to grow food could especially benefit people who are food insecure, Checker said. But because agri-hoods are often tied to real estate prices and developers want a return on their investment, it's much more likely that these kinds of projects go into gentrifying neighborhoods in more affluent neighborhoods, she said. It's not clear just how big a role the farm plays in attracting buyers. At Agritopia, for example, a few of the 500 homes participate in the farm box program that offers them first pick of seasonal fruits and vegetables. The farm also sells at a market in downtown Gilbert and donates to a local food pantry. Johnson said he knew not everyone's going to be passionate about agriculture. That's why he was intent on creating a village where people have space to come together. It's up to them how much, if at all. They want to be involved in farming. Still, farms are a selling point for developers, especially across the Sun Belt, who compete to offer pools, gyms, parks, and other perks to would-be residents who have a wide range of planned communities to choose from, said Scott Snodgrass. He's the founding partner of a developer that created Indigo, an agri-hood outside Houston, and also of a company called Agmenity that runs farms for agri-hood developers. As the sun rises, the farm's workers snip the roots off scallions and pull up thick bunches of lettuce and green garlic. Before he started working at Agritopia, Ernest Penoba didn't know all the steps involved in growing garlic, harvesting, cleaning, plus packing and transporting. But we only perceive it as one process, so it was really interesting to understand that, he said, speaking in Spanish. C.C. Garrett, who goes by Miss Hickory when she's leading educational tours for kids on the farm, said she loves watching young people connect with their food in new ways, eating and maybe enjoying salad for the first time, or learning why you can't grow tomatoes year-round. It's amazing for me just because this community, it just really speaks to me. Being built around the urban farm, which I think is such an important American concept, she said. For some who live here, this place is more than a typical neighborhood. In Agritopia's Kid Pond, a cluster of families with 23 kids between them, parents let the young ones roam freely, knowing at least one guardian will always be looking out for them. The rest of the parents make dinner or plan a date night. Just across the street, a peach or citrus orchard sways in the breeze, occasionally wafting the smells of fruit into front yards. Maria Padron lives in a kid pod with her husband and two children. She loves living in Agrotopia for the sense of camaraderie with her neighbors. Her own family in Virginia had to give up their farm when her grandfather couldn't take care of it anymore. She wishes it had stayed in the family, but it's a vineyard now. Asked whether she would have wanted her grandfather's land to become an agrihood, she says maybe if it was done right. There's something obviously beautiful here that's going on, but there's some grief there too. If you watch this land be a certain thing and then it changes within an instant, Padron said. I will pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The first article is titled Supervisor Renews Bid for Ballot Handout, Hand Counts. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Dateline Phoenix. A Mojave County supervisor is renewing his bid to trim the legal rights of Attorney General Chris Mays. Ron Gould contends that Mays constitutes a real threat to his powers and duties to certify elections simply because he believes that supervisors should be able to order a full hand count. But so far, he has been unable to make his arguments after a trial judge last year tossed out his lawsuit, saying he has not shown any imminent threat of prosecution. Now Gould is asking the State Court of Appeals to issue a ruling declaring he does have the legal right to pursue a case and directing Maricopa County Court Judge Bradley Ostrowski to let him present his evidence. The new bid is getting a fight from Assistant Attorney General Alexander Samuels. He is telling the appellate court that Gould's claims are speculative, especially as he has not articulated a concrete plan to violate the law in the future. Samuels also pointed out that state law requires the use of electronic tabulation of ballots, not the kind of hand count that Gould has pushed for in the past year and may be seeking in the future. He noted that Gould is not challenging the legality of that law, but simply wants a declaration that he can't be prosecuted for breaking it. The board has no statutory authority to authorize a hand count, Samuels said. And he said that means supervisors must follow existing law, the one requiring the use of tabulation machines, unless and until the legislature determines otherwise. The outcome of the legal fight could have statewide implications. Supervisors in some other counties have raised their own concerns about the accuracy of machine counting, and if Gould ultimately wins, it could pave the way for them to ignore the law requiring electronic tabulation of ballots without fear of prosecution. The fight in Mojave County dates back to 2023, when the board, which is charged with certifying the election returns, voted to consider a hand count for 2024 races. It was scrapped by a 3-2 vote against the plan in August amid various practical concerns, with Gould voting to proceed with the hand count. But 3 months later, board chair Travis Lingenfelter, who had been one of the foes, put the issue back on the agenda. That gave Senate Majority Leader Sonny Borelli, Republican of Lake Havasu City, a chance to argue to the board a hand count would be legal. It was also at the same meeting, however, that the letter from Mays was read to the board. She warned the supervisors that going down that path could result in various felonies and misdemeanor penalties. We hope you will choose not to violate the law, and thus it will not be necessary to consider whether criminal prosecution is warranted for conducting an illegal hand count, the Attorney General wrote. So the board backed down over Gould's objections, something he said he would not have done but for May's threats. In his appeal, Dennis Welnicek, Gould's attorney, said the actions of the Attorney General undermine the concept that lawmakers, including supervisors, generally have immunity from being charged for making decisions. And he told the judges that lawmakers needed to be able to execute the functions of their office without fear of prosecutions, civil or criminal. But all that, Wolinchek said, will be undermined if Gould cannot get the court order he desires to block Mays from prosecuting him if he decides in the future that a hand count is necessary. Wolinchek said the letter was addressed to Gould as a supervisor. That, he said, clearly supports that and a real threat exists that Ron Gould will be prosecuted under the criminal election statutes. Wolinchek said all that provides a legal basis to direct the trial judge to hear the arguments and evidence and determine whether Mays should be precluded from bringing future charges. The attorney general's threats were not idle and empty, he told the appellate judges. And he said that that is buttressed by the fact that just 8 days after sending the letter, Mays secured the indictment of two Cochise County supervisors who were charged with felonies, including conspiring to delay the formal canvass of votes from the election over their questions about whether the machine counts were reliable. Wolinchek also pointed out to the appellate judges that Mays had had an opportunity to disavow any intent to enforce the law about the hand counts against Gould and has refused to do so. But Gould faces another legal hurdle even if the appellate court sends the case back to Ostrowski. The trial judge already has said even if anything Mays did constitutes a real threat, there may be nothing that he or another court can do about it. It is a violation of the separation of powers for the judicial branch to tell the executive branch what it can and cannot do concerning an act that has yet to occur, Ostrowski wrote in his original ruling. The executive branch enjoys discretion when it carries out its function, he continues. The judicial branch cannot eliminate that discretion. In essence, that means only if and when Gould is charged with a crime could a court have jurisdiction to determine whether he had broken a law and whether that law is constitutional. Tied up in all this, but not directly before the court, is what has become a perennial question of the reliability of electronic tabulation. Arizona courts have rejected various lawsuits contending that tabulation equipment produced incorrect results in the 2022 election. The Brennan Center for Justice also has concluded that hand counting actually is more likely to produce errors. And federal courts all the way up to the Supreme Court rejected arguments by Kerry Lake and Mark Fincham that machines used in some Arizona counties to tally ballots are so inherently unreliable that the use of them violates their constitutional rights. Still, there can be issues. Officials in Milwaukee had to return about 31,000 ballots in the 2024 election because the doors of the tabulator machines were not locked and sealed as they should be. But there are checks built into the system in Arizona, like requirements for machines to be tested before and after elections. Arizona law also requires a random hand count audit where the ballots from a certain number of precincts are tabulated by hand to see if the totals match what the machines have counted. Gould, however, has argued there's a valid reason for his desire to pursue a hand count and get a ruling that he can't be prosecuted for future attempts to get the supervisors to do so. My concern is that my constituents are losing faith in the election process, he said. No date has been set by the appellate court to consider the issue. The next item from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Future of Traditional Healing Benefit Unclear. This article was written by Stephanie Innes of the Arizona Republic. A years-long effort to make Arizona one of the first states in the country to have traditional healing as a Medicaid benefit is in peril after stalling in the most recent legislative session. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs has included a $1.3 million appropriation for the benefit in her executive budget for the 2026 fiscal year, but it's unclear whether the Arizona legislature will agree to keep it in during its upcoming budget process. Proponents of including traditional healing as a covered Medicaid benefit predict it will result in cost-saving and long-term health benefits. American Indians and Alaska Natives have significant health disparities when compared with the general population. Yet even with bipartisan support, a bill to approve the benefit did not get a hearing in the State House of Representatives during the ongoing session. So getting the benefit approved will come down to the budget process. The Arizona House Appropriations Committee Chair, Representative David Livingston, Republican of Peoria, and Vice Chair Representative Matt Gress, Republican of Phoenix, did not immediately respond to requests for comments on May 28th. The Medicaid program in Arizona is called the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or AHCCS, pronounced ACCESS. It is a government health insurance program primarily for low-income people that enrolls nearly 2 million Arizonans and about 8% of those enrollees, or 166,480 people, are Native American, according to ACCESS data. Arizona is one of four states in the country that in October got the okay from the federal government to make traditional healing a Medicaid benefit. But it's the only one of the four states that needs the go-ahead from its legislature to put the benefit into action. The other states are Oregon, California, and New Mexico. The disappointment in the room was pretty big when members of a tribal working group who had been working to get the ACCESS benefits learned that traditional healing bill did not make it through the legislative process, said Yevik Siki, a traditional healer for Gila River Healthcare and a member of the Gila River Indian community. Siki said he will continue with traditional counseling he practices no matter what, but the state approval would go a long way in legitimizing methods of healing that have a long history of marginalization and persecution. Traditional healing in the U.S. was criminalized for nearly a century under the 1883 Federal Code of Indian Offenses. That law was not fully reversed until the 1978 American Indian Religious Freedom Act passed. Though the vast majority of funding for the traditional healing benefit will come from the federal government, which has a 100% matching rate for indigenous people, the state appropriation is necessary because some state funding may be needed for non-native people who qualify for services at or through tribal facilities, Arizona Medicaid officials have said. The governor included funding for traditional healing practices in her executive budget. Hobbs' spokesman, Christian Slater, wrote in an email to the Arizona Republic, responding to a question about the status of the benefit. Legislation requiring appropriations is typically addressed in the budget, and this will be discussed in our ongoing conversations with the legislature. ACCESS, which is often neutral on proposed state laws, was in favor of the bill that aimed to lock the benefit into place. Senate Bill 1671, sponsored by State Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez, Democrat of Tucson. ACCESS officials worked with tribal leaders and traditional healers in getting federal approval and supported the bill during the legislative process. Other supporters included the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. The Arizona Academy of Family Health, Family Physicians, and the Phoenix-based Vitalist Health Foundation, which works to improve health and well-being in Arizona. Gonzalez's bill got unanimous approval from the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and was passed by the full state Senate in a vote of 18-9 with three people not voting. Siki is one of four traditional healers who work for Gila River Healthcare, but he said the health system would have 10 and they would be all busy. His patients range in ages from 10 years old to elderly, and he goes to patients' homes, sees them in his office, and also works with patients, including those in psychiatric crisis. At the Huhu Camp Memorial Hospital in the tribal community capital of Secatan. ACCESS defines traditional healthcare practices as a sum total of knowledge, skill, and practices based on the theories, benefits, and experiences indigenous to different cultures, whether explicable or not, used in the maintenance of health as well as the prevention, diagnosis, improvement, or treatment of physical and mental illness. Traditional practices vary depending on the community and the healer. Some work through prayers, song, talking circles, and sweat lodges. Siki focuses on counseling and finds the most prevalent issue for patients he sees is existing in a world that is changing so fast. And he works to help those people find balance in their lives. During the Senate's Health Committee hearing about Gonzalez's bill, several members of the Navajo Nation said that getting access reimbursements for traditional healing would allow tribal health entities to grow their programs and make them sustainable. Our next article is titled Fireworks Shows on Track Despite Recent Fires. This article is written by Erica Wurst of the Arizona Daily Star. 4th of July fireworks displays are expected to be launched, as usual, across the Tucson area, despite a rash of recent wildfires that have burned thousands of acres in southern Arizona. City and town officials from Marana to Tucson to Oro Valley and Suarita say they are moving forward with plans for Independence Day shows. Between 18,000 and 20,000 people are expected to spend the 4th of July at Marana's Star Spangled Spectacular, which includes a 20-minute fireworks display. Marana is planning a robust safety protocol leading up to the big event and received an extra safety boost thanks to a recent brush fire in the Santa Cruz Wash that burnt away a lot of potential wildfire fuel near the town's fireworks launch site, said Shelby Shear, the town's recreation supervisor. It actually helped us to be a lot safer, Shear said. Firefighters also did a bit of backburning in that area to prevent fires from feeding off brush. We're really confident in our safety plan, she said. The safety of all guests is paramount to our operations. Oro Valley will be working closely with its first responders on July 4th when residents gather at James Creek Park with their eyes on the sky. On the ground, police, fire, and pyrotechnic experts will be working together to launch fireworks safely into the dark sky. The explosives will be launched from a secured fallout zone, and that fire suppression equipment and first responders will be on site should anything get out of control, said Jeffrey Hidalgo, a town spokesman. If at any time during the event Oro Valley is advised that conditions are not right for the show, we would certainly honor that, Hidalgo added. We are certainly taking all necessary precautions and are being mindful of the current wildfire activity in southern Arizona. Tucson plans to celebrate its 28th annual A Mountain 4th of July celebration, a show where fireworks are launched from the top of Sentinel Peak. The show is put on by a professional pyrotechnics company and is closely monitored by the Tucson Fire Department, said Andy Squire, a city spokesman. If conditions were to change, worsen, and our fire professionals felt that the risk has become too great, then the city manager will take that information to the mayor and council for a decision to be made, he said. Suarita had a few issues to deal with this 4th of July season, including where they'd set up and shoot off their traditional fireworks show. Encroaching homes and businesses have made it incredibly difficult to find a safe launch site, said Davin Selder, Suarita's Parks and Recreation Director. There is no safe shoot site in our growing community, and fire restrictions make it harder and harder to find a location, he said. We got to the point where we realized that a long-term, traditional big show was not going to work for us. So Stelder and his co-workers got creative, contracting with a pyrotechnic drone show, which he opens will continue for the long term. It's an easier show to manage and likely safer for us as a town. We are certainly taking all necessary precautions and are being mindful of the current wildfire activity in southern Arizona, Jeffrey Hidalgo is quoted, a town spokesman. Now it's time to flip the pages to the Nation on the World section of the Arizona Daily Star to check out several important news articles there. First item is titled President Withdraw Musk Associate to Lead NASA. This article was produced by the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. President Donald Trump said he is withdrawing the nomination of tech billionaire Jared Isaacman, an associate of Trump advisor Elon Musk, to lead NASA, saying he reached the decision after a thorough review of Isaacman's prior associations. It was unclear what Trump meant and that the White House did not respond to an email request for an explanation. After a thorough review of prior association, I am hereby withdrawing the nomination of Jared Isaacman to head NASA, Trump wrote late Saturday in a social media site. I will soon announce a new nominee who will be mission-aligned and put America first in space. In response, Isaacman thanked Trump and the Senate, writing on X that the past 6 months were enlightening and honestly a bit thrilling. It may not always be obvious through the discourse and turbulence, but there are many competent, dedicated people who love this country and care deeply about the mission, he said. That was on full display during my hearing, where leaders on both sides of the aisle made clear they're willing to fight for the world's most accomplished space agency. Trump announced in December during the presidential transition that he had chosen Isaacman to be the space agency's next administrator. Isaacman, 42, was a close collaborator with Musk ever since buying his first chartered flight on Musk's SpaceX company in 2021. He is a CEO and owner of Shift4, a credit card processing company. The next item is titled, 31 Killed While Going to Get Aid. This article was written by Muhammad Jahu and Sami Magdi of the Associated Press, Dateline Rafah, Gaza Strip. At least 31 people were killed and over 170 were wounded Sunday while on their way to receive food in the Gaza Strip, health officials and witnesses said. Witnesses said Israeli forces fired on crowds about 1,000 yards from an aid site run by an Israeli-backed foundation. It was the deadliest incident yet to the new aid distribution system, which has operated for less than a week. Israel's military said in a statement its forces did not fire at civilians near or within the site. An Israeli military official speaking on condition of anonymity in line with procedure said troops fired warning shots at several suspects advancing toward them near the site. The foundation, promoted by Israel and the United States, said in a statement it delivered aid without incident. It has denied previous accounts of chaos and gunfire around its sites, which are in Israeli military zones where independent media has no access. The International Committee of the Red Cross said in a statement its field hospital in the southern city of Rafah received 179 casualties, including women and children, 21 of them declared dead upon arrival, the majority with gunshot or shrapnel wounds. All patients said they had been trying to reach an aid distribution site, the ICRC said, calling it the highest number of weapon-wounded people in a single incident since the hospital was set up over a year ago. Aid distribution has become a death trap. The head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philippe Lazzarani, said in a statement. In a separate statement, Israeli Military Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir ordered that more aid sites be established and that troops' ground operation be expanded in an unspecified parts of northern and southern Gaza. Multiple witnesses have said Israeli troops fired on crowds near the new Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. Before Sunday, 17 people were killed while trying to reach them, according to Zaire Al-Wahidi, head of the Gaza Health Ministry's Records Department. The foundation says private security contractors guarding its sites have not fired on crowds. Israeli military has acknowledged firing warning shots on previous occasions. The foundation said in a statement it distributed 16 truckloads of aid early Sunday without incident and dismissed what it described as false reporting about deaths, mass injuries, and chaos. UN agencies and major aid groups have refused to work with the system, saying it violates humanitarian principles. Thousands of people headed toward the distribution site hours before dawn. As they approached, Israeli forces ordered them to disperse and come back later, witnesses said. When the crowds reached the flag roundabout, about 1,000 yards away at around 3 a.m., Israeli forces opened fire, the witnesses said. There was a fire from all directions, from naval warships, from tanks, and drones, said Amr Abu Taiba, who was in the crowd. Our next article from The Nation and the World is and of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Thousands Are Evacuated. This article was presented by the Associated Press, Flin Flon, Manitoba. More than 25,000 residents in three provinces were evacuated as dozens of fires remained active Sunday and diminished air quality in parts of Canada and the U.S., according to officials. Most of the evacuated residents were from Manitoba, which declared a state of emergency last week. About 17,000 people there were evacuated by Sunday, or rather Saturday, along with 1,300 in Alberta. About 8,000 people in Saskatchewan were relocated as leaders there warned the number could climb. Smoke was worsening air quality and reducing visibility in Canada and into some U.S. states along the border. Air quality and visibility due to wildfire smoke can fluctuate over short distances and can vary considerably from hour to hour, Saskatchewan's Public Safety Agency warned Sunday. As smoke levels increase, health risks increase. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe said ongoing hot, dry weather is allowing some fires to grow and threaten communities, and resources to fight the fires and support the evacuees are stretching thin. The next 4 to 5 days are absolutely critical until we can find our way to changing weather patterns and ultimately a soaking rain throughout the north, Moe said at a Saturday news conference. In Manitoba, about 5,000 of those evacuated are from Flin Flon, located about 400 miles northwest of the provincial capital of Winnipeg. In northern Manitoba, fire knocked out power to the community of Cranberry Portage, forcing a mandatory evacuation order Saturday for about 600 residents. The fire menacing Flin Flon began a week ago near Creighton, Saskatchewan, and quickly jumped the boundary into Manitoba. Crews have struggled to contain it. Water bombers have been intermittently grounded due to heavy smoke and a drone incursion. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service deployed an air tanker to Alberta and said it would send 150 firefighters and equipment to Canada. In some parts of the U.S., air quality reached unhealthy levels Sunday in North Dakota and small swaths of Montana, Minnesota, and South Dakota, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency AirNow page. We should expect at least a couple more rounds of Canadian smoke to come through the U.S. over the next week, said Brian Jackson, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in the U.S. Separately, a fire in the U.S. border state of Idaho burnt at least 100 acres as of Sunday, prompting road closures and some evacuations, according to the Idaho Department of Lands. The agency said in a news release that at least one structure was burnt, but did not provide details about the damage. Strong gusty winds of 15 to 20 miles per hour and steep terrain were making it difficult for firefighters battling the fire, which ignited Saturday. Now we'll head over to the business section for a useful article titled, Funding Cuts Create Job Drought. Please note, due to time constraints, this article will be abridged. This article was written by Augusta Sariva and Michael Sasso of the Bloomberg News. U.S. openings in research and development plunged as the Trump administration ramps up funding cuts to government agencies, private contractors, and universities, leaving some of the nation's brightest minds scrambling to find work. Scientific research and development job postings are down 18%, since President Donald Trump took office in January, compared to a 4% drop in overall vacancies in both the public and private sectors, according to a report Thursday from the Indeed Hiring Lab. The decline was broad-based across the science sector, which also impacted data collection jobs and life sciences consulting. Trump's effort to shrink the federal workforce and halt scientific research funding are a blow to job seekers interested in government-funded jobs at top-notch institutions like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Columbia University. The funding cuts also trickle into a private sector with pharmaceuticals and other grant-exposed industry anticipating weaker hiring ahead. "We're already seeing a spillover," said Corey Stahl, an economist at Indeed and author of the report. While science jobs constitute less than 1% of postings on Indeed job search platform, they carry an outsized effect because they have a pretty big social impact, but also financial impact on other businesses. Anxiety began mounting after Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. unveiled plans in late March to cut 10,000 employees from the department's workforce. Many of its nearly 30 divisions, including the CDC, National Institutes of Health, and the Food and Drug Administration, already carried out sizable layoffs. Since then, the Trump administration also canceled billions of dollars in federal grants and contracts to universities, including Columbia, Harvard, and Northwestern, citing their handling of anti-Semitism and discrimination on campus. As mentioned at the beginning of this business section reading, this article was an abridged version due to time constraints. Therefore, due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, June 2nd, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.